Funeral sandwiches is ghoulish and delicious. And you're just wonderful, crazy people, all of you. Tonight is going to be a special night, or maybe a strange night for me. Because growing up, I got the privilege of listening to my dad speak on a regular basis. And tonight's the first night I'm going to speak with my son in the crowd, in the chairs. He will be quizzed after this. And if he is found wanting, there will be summary Bible study work. Please turn to Genesis 22. The story of Abraham begins with God calling him out of Ur, a city which has a patron deity whose name in Akkadian, I kid you not, is Sin. Now, I don't want to read into that too much because it's also a name in 30 different names in 30 different languages, but I like that. Immediately, Abraham is called out of Sin. But his first action is to respond to this call is faith, is faithfulness. He trades in this city, this important city, for wilderness, and he trades in a lush valley at the time for desert, and he trades in his house for a tent. And the rest of his story is defined by faithfulness. In spite of his failures, of which there are some, he trusts his newfound God, and he follows him. He follows him where he sends him. And these promises that God makes him from the get-go, they kind of guide him through this process. And we see how he, trusting God, denies wealth from the people of this world, and in turn is rewarded with wealth. And he exchanges this life for the next life. And he firmly sets his life to be guided by God. And what comes from this faith, he gets friendship with God, the Bible says, and he gets fatherhood of nations, but also of Isaac, of an individual, of this wonderful little son. And the Lord provides for him at every turn. He meets his physical needs, and he protects his nephew, even if his nephew doesn't deserve it. And he gives him a son and an heir, and he gives him a promise. Through Abraham's faithfulness, God shows his faithfulness. And Abraham is shown dramatically that God is faithful and that God is powerful. And Abraham steps into God's plan, and he becomes a part of the story that won't be revealed fully for 2,000 more years or so. And in doing so, this childless patriarch, whose name means father, exalted father, becomes the father of nations and gets, for a few brief moments, even to be a picture of the heavenly father, of God the Father. And so in Genesis 22, we see this story of faith and provision and God's plan for the salvation of the world and the restoration of his lost creation. Let's just open in prayer. Dearly Father, Lord, I just want to thank you for this opportunity to come here and share from your word. And I pray that I would share clearly and that some of what I say is profitable, that I wouldn't stray too far from your truth, Lord. And I just pray that you'd give me calmness and peace and confidence in you. And I pray that you would give those here listening, Lord, some truth from your word. And thank you for your blessings and for your son and for your greatness and your goodness, Lord, in your son's name. Amen. Genesis 22 is a very interesting chapter. It has a bunch of firsts. So we're going to start with reading through it pretty quickly because we got a bit to cover. Now, it came about after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, "Abraham," and he said, "Here I am." He said, "Take now your son, your only son whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you." So Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him and Isaac his son, and he split wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham raised his eyes and saw the place from a distance. Abraham said to his young men, "Stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go over there, and we will worship and return to you." Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son. And he took in his hands the fire and the knife, so the two of them walked on together. Isaac spoke to Abraham his father and said, "My father." And he said, "Here I am, my son." And he said, "Behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" Abraham said, "God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." So the two of them walked on together. Then they came to the place which God had told him. And Abraham built the altar there and arranged the wood and bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham." And he said, "Here I am." And he said, "Do not stretch out your hand against the lad and do nothing for him, to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." Then Abraham raised his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in the thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering in the place of his son. And Abraham called the name of that place, "The Lord will provide. As it is said to this day, in the mount of the Lord it will be provided." Then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, "By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, indeed I will greatly bless you, and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore. And your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies. In your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." So Abraham returned to his young men, and they arose and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham lived at Beersheba. And we'll just stop there, because I couldn't find a way to fit genealogies into this message. Just out of curiosity, do we know if this is fresh water? Thank you so much. Because right now I've got the opposite of what you want. I got dry mouth and wet hands, so give me dry hands. This chapter has some interesting firsts. We like to look at firsts in chapters because I think you can, God in his infinite wisdom has laid importance on things, and we get an opportunity to maybe glimpse into the importance. And even if maybe we read into some things perhaps a bit too much sometimes, it still gives us an opportunity to focus on important themes in a chapter and learn from them. We see the first time the word love is used, or Hebrew word is Ahab, which that's odd. In Genesis 22:2, we see worship used for the first time in this context. It's used twice before to mean, and this is what worship translates to, very interestingly, to bow down, to physically to bow down. And the first time we see it, it's when the Lord and two angels approach Abraham as he sits in his tent, and his reaction is to bow down to them. It's the same word, shachah, or shachah, if you want to get chy about it. Then in Genesis 19, when the two angels, Christ now departed, go and meet Lot. It's Lot's response is to bow down, physically bow down. But there are differences. There are differences between those usages and this usage. First of all, it separates worship from strictly bowing. He is going up on this mountain and they're building an altar and they're sacrificing. This is the point of their journey, is to sacrifice. And Abraham says, "This is worship. This is what I'm doing." Interestingly, he's offering a burnt offering. And that's the second time this word is used in the Bible for burnt offering, which is olah. Just looking for Daniel. And it means literally that which goes up. So he's going, and this is the point, is he's sending something up above to the Lord, and he himself is beneath, is prostrated, is bowing down in worship. There are no angels in this case. It's just Abraham and Isaac and the Father and, well, the angel of the Lord, which is a special angel. And they went to worship this time, as opposed to the other times when the objects of the worship came to them, they went out to worship. And finally, the first of the words is tested, to test, when God tested Abraham. And we'll start there in verse 1. Now, it came about after these things that God tested Abraham. This can make maybe me feel a little bit nervous. I hear that. I hear God tested. You know, we have these, we think of tests, we think of generally bad things, Brent. but it's important to remember that tests have a purpose. They have a valuable purpose. The point of a test in education isn't to teach you necessarily. If you go into a test without having the information beforehand, you're not going to do well on the test. You're going to fail the test. You may even have the information beforehand, but if you choose not to engage in the test, if you choose not to write the test, you will fail the test. This testing has a purpose, and it's to reveal, it's to show that you know the information. In the context of education, it could be the course. But perhaps in Abraham's context, it's to show his faith. It's important to address that testing is different from temptation. In James 2, it's very clear that God does not tempt us. He does not put evil in front of us and entice us with it. In the Navy SEALs, all right, we'll start with the Navy SEALs. They have, to become a Navy SEAL, you need to go through a process. If Tony was here, it'd be HE Double Hockey Stick Week. But you have to go through Hell Week. That's what they call it. It's the official terminology. And you spend a week being miserable. That's what you do for a week. You carry these huge logs on the beach, and you run into the cold ocean, and you're with your team, and you have to make sure you're all together, and you swim for miles, and you go back on the beach, and you carry boats, and you sail in boats. And all the while, for this whole week, you do not sleep. You huddle, and for a few brief moments, maybe you'll get some sleep before the instructor comes by and yells at you to go carry more boats. But all the while, as Hell Week goes on, the instructors are there saying, do you want a meal? Do you want a warm meal? All you have to do is quit. Do you want to sleep in a bed? All you have to do is quit. Do you want to be warm for the first time in 5 days? Just quit. They're there. They're tempting you to quit. And this is not what's happening here. It's important to separate that God is not placing temptation in our lives. They're separate things. One is the encouragement and the enticement, external or internal, to do evil. It's an opportunity to fail. The other is an opportunity to do what's right and an opportunity to succeed. And in doing so, demonstrate knowledge or abilities or attributes. And in this case, it was an opportunity to externally and perhaps internally for Abraham, demonstrate and showcase and publicly declare and be declared faithful. And this is what we see of Abraham, that he had faith and he was faithful. Up to this, his whole life has been faith, faith, faith. And up to this final moment, which is a test, and it's a test of his faith. James 2 also is clear that faith without works is dead. It's lifeless. It can still be there. We can believe and be apathetic, or believe and be afraid, or believe and not follow through. But we cannot be useful without these works. And in verse 21 of James 2, it says, "Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered up Isaac his son on the altar? And the scripture was fulfilled, which says, 'And Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness.' And he was called the friend of God." Abraham is declared faithful by his passing of this test. He is declared righteous by his works. He was not made faithful by the passing of this test. God says to him after, he says, God said to him, "Abraham." And he said, "Here I am." Abraham is the first "here I am" of the Bible. And there's a few. You can go through and track them down. Here's some. Moses in Exodus 3, God calls to him from the midst of the bush, and he goes, Moses, Moses. And Moses goes, here I am. Jacob, in a dream, God calls to him, Jacob. Jacob says, here I am. And God says, leave this land and return to the land of your birth. Again to Jacob, God calls and says, Jacob, in a dream. And Jacob says, here I am. And God says, leave the land of your birth, go to Egypt, but don't worry, I'll bring you back. There's the call in Isaiah to be a messenger for God, which Isaiah answers, whom shall I send? And Isaiah says, here I am, send me. Samuel, all of the times he's called as a little boy, here I am, here I am, here I am. And then in Isaiah 58, 9, when we cry out to God, he says, here I am. The first time God calls out to someone is in the garden with Adam. And Adam doesn't say, here I am. He cowers and he hides. And the next time is Abraham. And Abraham says, here I am. We see this, you know, in our own lives. This is our responsibility of faith, is to, when we are called, we are to act. We are to listen and eagerly and promptly go forward. He said, take now your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah. Take now your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac. We see this increasing specificity and importance and seriousness. And in the end, God refers to him intimately by name. There is no doubt that God knows that Abraham cares for Isaac so deeply, and also that God knows Isaac. And we see that God has a son, an only son, whom he loves. And he's also a sacrifice on a mountain in the land of Moriah. Land of Moriah, by the way, Moriah means chosen of Jehovah. And, you know, you wonder where it got this name, because here in this passage, God uses the name already. He says, you're good to go to the land of Moriah. But it's also doubly chosen because God specifically picks this land, which is a 3 days journey away. It's not close. And he not only just picks the land, he picks a point in that land, a peak on a mountain. And they go there. And fundamentally, it's this place of sacrifice and worship. And God shows it to be this place. And Abraham, he gets up the next day. He says he rises early in the morning. There's three times we're told that Abraham rises early to do things. And once is to go see what had become of Sodom and Lot after God sent fire from heaven to destroy Sodom. The other time is when Abraham... sends Hagar out into the desert. And the other time is here now when he rises to go and sacrifice his son Isaac. What we learn from this is that waking up early in the morning means bad things are about to happen. So don't. That's biblical. but Abraham, what he does is he gets up and he chops the wood and he saddles the donkey and he gets the young men. And instead of saying, all right, young men, do these things for me, he says, no, we're doing this. We're going to be prompt. We're serving. And he serves and he goes about it. On the third day, Abraham raised his eyes and he saw the place from a distance. Someday we'll be done with lists, but we have another list here. He raises his eyes. Abraham does this. It's an interesting phrase because you think to raise your eyes must be down. Your eyes must be looking elsewhere. It's hard to not read the story and be emotional because you think he's riding with his son these 3 days. And so you think, why is his head down? Maybe it's sorrow, but maybe it's prayer. It's down in prayer, but he looks up and he sees Mount Moriah. In Genesis 13, we see Lot lifts up his eyes, and he sees the Valley of the Jordan. This is when Abraham has given him the opportunity to pick where he wants to live. And Lot sees the Valley of the Jordan, and I think how we tend to often look at things first, he looks with the eyes of the flesh. And he says, look how good this land is. And it was good, to be fair. And Abram was a good uncle and a man who was getting increasingly used to relying on God for guidance and for direction. And what is he left with here? He's left with dry, arid land away from the life-giving waters of the Jordan. And this is interesting. What looks like life to the flesh is often used as an image of death in the Bible. We see these, the Jordan and these rushing waters. But after Lot leaves in Genesis 13, the Lord speaks to Abram. And he tells him, lift up your eyes and look. Look out. What I see when I see this desert. And the Lord shows him. And with these eyes that have used to look here. And he says, look up. Raise your eyes. And gaze beyond the here and the now and the metrics of success and the kingdoms and the economies of this world. And look into this beautiful plan that God has for Abraham and his descendants and the world all wrought through faith and grace. And it all begins in this dry and arid desert that he says, someday this will be yours. And at this point, Abraham raises his eyes and he looks up and he sees. In Genesis 18, he lifts his eyes and he sees the Lord and the two angels coming to his home. And in response, he worships and he bows down. And I think this should still be our response. When we lift up our eyes and we see God, what can we do but bow down and worship? And then we see in Genesis 22, he lifts up his eyes and he sees Mount Moriah in the distance, which is the end of his present earthly journey and the place of sacrifice and worship and faith that God has chosen for him. And he sees where his son will die. And he sees the place where his God will be glorified. And he sees the mount where the Lord will somehow still carry on this plan that he's told Abraham. So Abraham says to his young men, stay here with the donkey. And I and the lad will go over there and we will worship and we will return to you. This is that first usage of the word worship. This bowing down, lowering before him, and Abraham provides the ultimate example. Also, it's important, Abraham's not a liar here. He firmly believes, and Hebrews tells us that he believes firmly that God will raise Isaac from the dead. This is what he thinks the solution will be. So he says, we'll return, and he believes this. He believes he's going to sacrifice Isaac, but God in his mercy will raise him from the dead. Abraham now, he takes the wood of the burnt offering and he lays it on Isaac, and he took in his hand the fire and the knife, so the two of them walked on together. And Isaac spoke to Abraham, his father, and said, my father, and he said, here I am, my son. And he said, behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? And Abraham said, God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. So the two of them walked on together. Here's another, here I am. And this time it's Abraham as the father. And this is his service. This is his duty as a father. When the son cries out to him, he says, here I am. And in that way, he serves too. The provision of God is beautiful. And this is where he has faith. He has faith in the provision of God. Then in verse 9, then they came to the place which God had told him. And Abraham built the altar there. And arranged the wood and bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. And now Abraham worships how God dictates, the location and the method. And it's not an easy method. It's not a pleasing method. It's not a receptive method. It's not Abraham receiving something, goodness and peace and all of these good things, which sometimes we associate with worship. It's God's way and God's place, and he does it, and it's hard. And now we're just going to read, I think, again, 10 to 19 again, because it's, I think this is it. This is the crux of this chapter. Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here I am. And he said, do not stretch out your hand against the lad and do nothing to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, for me. Then Abraham raised his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in the thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering in the place of his son. And Abraham called the name of that place, the Lord will provide, as it is said to this day, in the mount of the Lord it will be provided. Then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, by myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing, and you have not withheld your only son, indeed I will greatly bless you. And I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heaven and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies, And in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. So Abraham returned to his young men, and they arose and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham lived at Beersheba. Abraham stretches out his hand to sacrifice his son, his only son, whom he loves, Isaac. And he does so in faith and obedience and certainty that the Lord is going to resurrect his son. And he's going to be faithful to his promise. And he brings the knife to his son with certain faith that God would resurrect his son. At the end of Luke, it says, "Why are you troubled?" This is Christ saying this to the disciples. "Why are you troubled, and why did doubts arise in your hearts? Thus it is written that the Christ would suffer and rise again from the dead on the third day." And we see in this so gentle rebuke, Christ so gently rebukes the disciples after he's risen for not believing that he would rise. But Abraham needs no such rebuke. Abraham is commended for his faith that God would bring his son Isaac back to life, even where the disciples did not believe that God would bring his son Jesus back to life. So he stretches out the knife to slay his son. And once more, the Lord calls out to him by name. He says, "Abraham, Abraham." And with the knife in his hand one last time, Abraham says, "Here I am." He's ready. He's ready to serve. And perhaps this is with immediacy and eagerness and obedience and relief, he says, "Here I am." And the verses, "Do not stretch out your hand against the lad and do nothing to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." We have a very distinct blessing and privilege in the church right now. When we read the Old Testament, we get this twofold blessing, okay? First, when we read it looking forwards, and we get to read these stories, and we get to see the attributes of God and how he establishes his people, and we get to read, on a kind of shallow level, we get to read really interesting stories, and they're enjoyable, and they're wild, and they're strange, and they're thought-provoking, and they're shocking, and we get to learn. We get to learn about God. But then, when that's through, we get this opportunity to read it looking backwards from our vantage point, having the New Testament, and having seen God's revelation. And we get this opportunity to see not just how God is planning, but how God was planning throughout this whole process. We get to see Christ revealed at every page of the story and every step of the journey. And we can look back all the way to when Eve tastes of the fruit, and we can see how God has a plan. He has a plan to deal with this broken relationship and this broken world, even from that moment. And so we get the opportunity to lift up our eyes, enlightened by the Lord, and look for his plan and his son in this story. And we are treated to maybe the most vivid, clear, beautiful story of God's plan in the Old Testament, and just this picture of him and his son. So let's go back. Let's go back, start at verse 5. The father and the son go alone. It's like when the darkness descends on Christ on the cross. We don't get to see what happened there. And not just us. And it's not just Abraham's servants that are left behind. But I think of how Christ calls John, the disciple who I love. He's not let in. And Mary and the other Mary, the two Marys, they're not let in. But he loves them and they love him. This is a private moment. This is a moment, a sacred moment between Christ and the Father. They were alone and Abraham and Isaac went up alone. In verse 6, Abraham lays the wood on the back of Isaac. And, well, Christ takes the cross up on his back as he goes up to Calvary. And they walk on, the two of them together. Abraham takes things too. He takes the knife that slays and the fire that burns. And these are implements of sacrifice. And it's not our place to speculate on what happened between the Father and the darkness of Calvary. But When it ends, when the darkness lifts, Christ says, it is finished. Whatever's happened is done. And then we get verses 7 and 8. We get when Isaac looks around and says, we have everything but the lamb. We have everything but the sacrifice. And we get three provisions. We get three provisions in Abraham's answer. Let me just find the verse here. And Abraham said, let's back it up. My father. And he said, here I am, my son. And he said, behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? And Abraham said, God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. And this, there are three provisions here. We see, we see that Abraham believed that God had provided this perfect little lamb, Isaac. And he also believes that God will bring him back, that God will provide that way. So let's say there's four provisions here, but three is nicer, so we'll stick with three. We see that God provided a ram, which Abraham could sacrifice in Isaac's place as an act of this beautiful worship and thanksgiving to the Lord. But also we see that God would provide a lamb, his own son, to be an offering in Isaac's place for Abraham and for the nation of Israel and for us. We get to see this provision that he would provide some 2,000 years later. And we see that Isaac accepts this. He accepts this with faith and obedience. He's a faithful son, and he's an obedient son. And he's willing to believe his father and the Lord. And so they go up together on this lonely mountain up to worship the Lord in obedience to the Lord. And in verse 9, Isaac is laid on the altar. And the Bible doesn't say if Isaac resisted. He's a young man, and Abraham is so very, very old. He's over 100, but nevertheless, Isaac is bound. Oh, Christ too is bound. In Matthew 27:2, he was bound and led away and delivered to Pilate. But moments before he's bound, the mere utterance of his name from his lips brings them to their knees. And instead of putting their faith in him, they put their faith in this rope made from reeds that he spoke into existence. And they expect this rope to bind him, and they expect death to bind him. But in the end, no restraint is needed. He's a willing sacrifice. He goes to sacrifice for us, and death doesn't bind him, and the ropes couldn't bind him. But what we see is we'd see Isaac bound, and he's placed on this altar. And then in verse 10, the story, it deviates. It deviates from this picture. And it ceases to be a direct picture. And it returns to this story of a father and a son on a mountain. I think it's an interesting question. Why does it deviate? Why doesn't it keep going? If this is a test of Abraham's faith, and we know he had the faith to continue, we know that God has the power to resurrect, why does the story deviate? And it's because while the father demands sacrifice, the son intercedes. Because it's not Isaac's place to be sacrificed, it's someone else's place to be sacrificed. And in verse 11, we see the angel of the Lord called him from heaven. Who is with Abraham and Isaac here on the mountain? It's the angel of the Lord. It's not an angel. This is a very important article difference here. It's not an angel of the Lord. It's the angel of the Lord. And it's the pre-incarnate Christ. It is the pre-incarnate Son of God who will 2,000 years later, on a mountain that is so very close to this one, willingly sacrifice himself in the place of Isaac and in the place of every last person who has lived and will live. And we raise our eyes and we see that this is a story of two faithful fathers and two obedient sons on this mountain where the Lord provides. And in this moment, God's plan for Abraham is protected, and his plan for the world is revealed. And I don't know when the devil understands how he's going to be defeated. But here on this mountaintop, the plan is revealed in such clarity, in such certainty. And in verse 12, Abraham's hand is stopped, and his knife doesn't kill his son. Do not stretch out your hand against the lad and do nothing to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. Well, God does not withhold his son either. And when it's Christ's time to be sacrificed, The knife isn't stopped, and God's son, his only son, the son whom he loves, Jesus, is slain on the cross. And as the story of Abraham and Isaac deviates, we pick up in the story of God and the son, and it just falls so clearly into place in this process. And then Abraham lifts up his eyes, and he sees God's next provision. He sees a ram caught by the horns in a thicket. And he takes this knife, which moments ago he was going to use to slay his son, and he frees his son. He cuts the son's bonds, and he slays the ram, and he sacrifices the ram in the place of Isaac. And not because he must sacrifice here, but because Isaac has been freed and because he loves the Lord his God and he wants to worship. That's why he's here. He's here to worship. And he wants to. And God has provided an opportunity for him to worship after this moment. And it's important to remember where we are in this story, physically where we are. We're on Mount Moriah. Or let's be clear, a mountain in the land of Moriah. But from this place on, there is now a mount in the Bible called Mount Moriah. And this is the mount where David sees the angel of the Lord. It's where the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite is located. And he sees, after the Lord's gone and judged, he sees him standing on the mount with his sword. But it's also the place where the temple is built. And it's the place where the temple is destroyed and where the temple is rebuilt. And the temple is destroyed and someday will be rebuilt again. But this ram's blood is the first. It's the first sacrifice and first blood shed on this mountain where there will be countless thousands of animals who are slain and whose blood is shed and poured out on this ground. And it's all ineffectual in the actual dealing with the issue. And it's all a picture looking forward to the one true sacrifice whose blood will be effectual, who will be able to solve the problem of sin. And every death pointing towards that death would finally put an end to the power of death and sin. He names this mountain the Lord will provide, or as the Hebrew word ra'ah, which is here translated will provide, also can be translated, and is translated much more frequently, will be seen, will be beheld, will see, will enjoy, will hear. I'm sure Abraham knew what he was saying when he said, well, this is the Lord will provide, but I do think it's beautiful that we can look to it. And from this day forward, we can look at this picture and think, this is the place where the Lord will provide. And this is the place where the Lord saw Abraham and Isaac, and this is the place where the Lord interceded, and this is the place where the Lord enjoyed worship. Then we have the last three verses, the angel of the Lord, he again speaks from heaven. And up until this point, on several occasions, God has spoken of what he will make of Abraham's descendants. In Genesis 13, when God promises the land to Abraham and his descendants, he numbers his descendants as the dust of the earth. And then in Genesis 15, when God promises an heir of his own Isaac and an heir of his own Christ, he points him to the heavens and says they'll be as numerous as the stars in the sky. But here, looking forward to the moment when earth and heaven meet and the divine becomes man and he comes and he gives his life. Well, here we see in verse 15 and 8 to 18, verse 17, indeed, I will greatly bless you and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heaven and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies. And then he says, not only this, but through your seed, all of the nations of the earth will be blessed. We will be blessed. And through his heir, this divine offspring that's promised, the angel of the Lord speaks of himself, the seed through which we are blessed, because Abraham was faithful and because Abraham obeyed. And Isaac and Abraham both return, as Abraham said to his servants, out of this private place in this private moment, out down the mountain, and together they return home. I just have a poem to read. I did not write this poem. Anastasia wrote this poem. Oh, I appreciate her endlessly for it. I'm going to read water. Drink water first. A father asked to slay his son, believed the boy would rise, for God had promised seed through him as stars up in the skies. A voice from heaven stayed the hand before the blood was shed. A ram found tangled in a bush was killed in Isaac's stead. How did the father show his fear of God or doubt had won? He gave one pure and poignant proof. He did not withhold his son. Another father gave his son. This time the son would rise, for God had promised help through him on a cross neath darkened skies. No voice from heaven stopped the scene, and so Christ's blood was shed, and the Lamb had finally come to earth and died in our own stead. How can we know we're given all, and our salvation's won? We have one sure and shocking sign. He has not withheld his son. All right, I'm just going to close in prayer before I break. All right, dearly Father, Lord, I just want to thank you for the beauty that is your word and the beauty that is your plan that you reveal to us so clearly and sometimes so subtly, but so beautifully through your word. And I thank you for your goodness and your greatness and your faithfulness to us. And I thank you for just these pictures we get to look at and these words we get to read. And I thank you mostly for our son, for your son, and his willingness to die for us, Lord, and for his resurrection, so we can spend an eternity with you, but also have a life here of purpose and value and meaning, Lord. And I thank you so much for this church you've built that we can be a part of, and this family we can be a part of, Lord. And so I just want to pray now, Lord, that we would take your word seriously, and that we would live lives of faith, trusting in your provision, Lord, and be made more and more every day like your son. In your son's name, amen.